Welcome to the Vox Markets podcast. Today we have Tim Steer, author of the book, The Signs Were There. It's great to have you on, Tim.
Yeah, hi.
Before we dive into it, could you give us a quick rundown of your background?
Yeah, I qualified with Ernst & Young as an accountant. I left Ernst & Young probably back in 87 off the top of my head and joined HSBC James Capewell as a small companies analyst and wrote the first bit of environmental research and then joined Merrill Lynch and became head of pan-European mid-cap research. I was there for 10 years. And after that, I moved from the sell side to the buy side, which is a sensible thing to have done, and was a hedge fund manager at Newstar when it all started. So I was a founding shareholder. And after 7-8 years there, I left and joined Artemis, where I was for 5-6 stroke happy years, where I ran a long fund and also a hedge fund.
Amazing. And after all those experiences, you've written this book. What sparked you to begin writing it? Was it a gradual project that you started putting together over time, or was there a light bulb moment sort of that led you to write this book?
I've spent most of my life in the city looking for problems in accounts. And I think I've got a bit of a reputation in that space. So when I stopped work a couple of years ago, I suddenly thought that there's a hell of a lot of experiences that I've had that might help other people. And I was particularly surprised to always see, you know, really quite pucker blue chip institutional investors getting caught in some of these kind of share price disasters and actually stock market or company disasters. So it was pretty evident to me that many of the great and the good in the world of investing don't necessarily look at the financial statements or the annual report of companies they invest in, because if they did, and if they knew where to look and if they understood them, they wouldn't have invested in the first place, or they would have got out certainly before the share price collapsed. And I think there's lots of telltale signs in companies' accounts which indicate that there is trouble ahead. And I thought I could talk about that in a sort of lively way. And it would be quite cathartic for me, quite an enjoyable process, and you know, be helpful to other people as well if I produce something like this.
It is readable for anyone who doesn't even study accounting, and I think that is really valuable in a book with the subject matter that you've written about.
That's good news.
It's been said your book is a worthy successor to Terry Smith's Accounting for Growth. What do you think has changed since the 80s and 90s when he wrote that compared to today or recent times?
Well, that's a hell of an accolade, because that's quite an important seminal book. So, but I'm surprised that no one's kind of written before me, really, because there's lots of interesting stories and more short stories, really, about companies. But I don't think really much has changed, to be perfectly honest. What I have noticed in putting the book together is that history repeats itself, and we know that in lots of ways, but certainly with companies falling out of bed and, you know, company disasters, there are precedents, and it seems to me that, you know, we don't necessarily learn those lessons. So maybe this book will help people. Lots of sort of similarities between companies going bust or falling off a cliff in this book and with previous, you know, companies, you know, 10, 15 years before. So it seems, as I said, history does repeat itself.
And you mentioned the iceberg principle, problems in accounts that are sometimes small and indicate larger issues ahead, which you elaborate in more detail in the book.
Yeah, I mean, you know, an iceberg, as we know, has got 10% of the ice above the water and the rest of the ice is below the waterline, so you can't see it. I think financial statements around your ports are a bit like icebergs in that, you know, they're never going to tell you everything about a company because, you know, that's divulging, you know, trade secrets to competitors, etc. But if you can see something that concerns you with a set of accounts above the metaphorical waterline, that is a good reason to steer clear, because you can bet your bottom dollar there'll be other things below the waterline that you can't see, which were likely to be equally as worrying. So, you know, I take an example of conviviality, which is a very recent 2018 company disaster. What I thought was interesting about Conviviality, which is, by the way, it was a drinks retailer, a tobacco retailer, and also a drinks and beer wholesaler. Mm-hmm. And what I think was very interesting about it is that it was very acquisitive. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It's one you have to be cautious about. But what was interesting is that when it bought Matthew Clark, who's a big, famous drinks wholesaler in the UK, it made a provision for onerous contracts of about $5 million after 10 months of owning it. That's perfectly okay. That's perfectly above board. But 12 months later, I, having owned the company Matthew Clark for 22 months, it made another provision for onerous contracts, so i.e. added to its existing one. So in other words, it's telling me that it got that very simple calculation wrong after 10 months of owning it. So that just tells me everything I need to know about that finance department as being, frankly, not up to it. And it should have been of no surprise to anyone, bearing in mind they had to have two stabs or two bites of the cherry, that it failed to account for duty and tax on drink and tobacco.
Wow.
And it got its forecasting wrong. That is a classic iceberg principle.
Mm. And you mentioned the statement, cash is fact, everything else is a matter of opinion, which seems to guide most of the principles in your book. That seems like a perfect or a very good example of that. Could you elaborate a little bit more on this?
Yeah, I mean, by and large, every single number in a P&L and a balance sheet, indeed a company's financial statements, is an estimate, a matter of judgment, it's a matter of opinion, apart from one thing, which is cash. Well, 99.9% of the time, cash is fact. Mm. It wasn't with Patisserie Valerie. It wasn't at Parmalat. It wasn't at Steinhoff, the South African retail conglomerate. But by and large, you can believe the cash in a balance sheet, in a P&L. All the other numbers are estimates or judgments. And the user of accounts or an investor has to feel comfortable that those judgments and estimates are reasonable. And that's kind of an overriding thing that one should always bear in mind when looking at companies' accounts and indeed investing in companies.
Yes. And the first example you mentioned in the book is how Connaught were capitalizing on various costs. Do you remember what happened when you initially highlighted it? Did you tell anyone at the time? Or?
Well, I can't remember actually, but I certainly told people around me at work. And you know, when you see something like that, the first thing you do if you own it is you sell it.
Right.
And if you don't own it and you're able to short the company through a CFD, contract for difference or something, then you would do that, because the company was well rated and yet it was keeping costs away from the P&L account, i.e. Overstating profits. And there's nothing wrong capitalizing certain costs, but there was something that I was concerned about with Connaught, because these numbers were so large. They were unreasonable in the context of the company itself. And I felt that these costs shouldn't have been, or a lot of these costs shouldn't have been capitalized. They should have been expensed to the P&L account.
Right. And the same thing seemed to sort of happen at Carillion as well, where you said that it should have been evident that they were going to fall as they're experiencing deteriorating current asset quality.
Yeah. Well, we're always looking for problem companies because we're running a hedge fund.
Right.
And we're always looking for companies that are overstating its profits. We're always looking for companies that, you know, may run out of cash. And Carillion, one of the things you have to remember about any balance sheet is that today's current assets are tomorrow's cash. Okay. Mm. So the ability to turn current assets, i.e. trade receivable, i.e. what you are owed by your customer, or amounts recoverable on contracts, what you are owed by your customer if you're building a bridge or a hospital or a building for him, or the accrued income that you've recognized that is due from your customer. If the current assets are increasingly moving to more subjective current assets. Obviously, current cash is not a subjective current asset. It's pretty much factual. Trade receivables, or what you're owed by your customers because you've invoiced them, that's a pretty good quality current asset. Less good quality is accrued income because it's an estimate, and less good quality is amounts recoverable on contracts because they are estimates and they are very difficult numbers for an auditor to check and audit. So I like to see a company growing its cash and growing its trade debtors, i.e. its receivables that have been invoiced. What you don't want to see is a lot of assets growing where they are just estimates. And we saw at Carillion very large movements on very large increases in accrued income and amounts recoverable on contracts, which increase the subjectivity and the degree of risk in those assets turning into cash going forward.
There seems to be a very distinct difference between these various accounting estimates. The head of small companies at Schroders said, "Your incisive eye and common sense approach, unfortunately, is not common in the market." What do you think helped you gain this common sense approach that the market does not seem to generally follow?
I guess I've just spent a long time looking at companies' accounts. Although I don't spend my life doing it, but I do find them quite interesting. And I do know where to look. So, you know, looking for a needle in a haystack is quite complicated. If you know where that needle is, roughly, it's a little easier.
Right.
So, if you've got a contractor, a construction company, you know you should look at the amounts recoverable on contracts as a first start.
Right.
If you've got to look at a retailer, you should look at the level of his stocks.
Right.
Okay. If you're looking at an employment company, employment agency, you look at, you know, this database. You know the key things, the key levers that need to be pulled or pushed to move that company and make sure it's profitable. And so I roughly know where to look. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think it's the responsibility of the investor, the buy side, to spot aggressive accounting and the sustainability of profits, or should the responsibility lie on management to use prudence when financial reporting?
Well, it's the management draw up the accounts and the auditor checks them, i.e. audits them. And therefore, the prime responsibility for the accounts of a company is the management. And the auditor has a part to play to check this. And so does the regulator, the FRC, the Financial Reporting Council. But in all cases in this book, in all 22 cases in this book, you know, there were signs that there was trouble ahead. And it means that investors missed those signs, because if they got caught as the share price collapsed and they got caught, they missed those signs. And those signs were there and ready to be read. And they weren't by a number of people. And that means that people aren't looking at the accounts in the way they should be.
Do you think there's a viable way for management to be prudent when there are such high pressures for them to achieve and sustain growth at any cost?
Well, it all comes down to honesty, doesn't it? And that's the overriding principle.
Right,
people have got to be honest.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's what you do expect, really.
Yeah, you would hope.
Funny old thing, but we do expect it.
You also mentioned in the book the availability of quality independent research has been going down due to a number of reasons, MiFID II being one of them.
Yes.
Do you think this will place more emphasis on the importance of annual reports, and what do you think the consequences are going forward?
Well, I think that MiFID II has not been great. I've not really, I've not heard anyone say it's the greatest thing ever. But what it means is that institutions and investors have now got to pay for that independent research or pay for that research from their own books rather than pass it through the actual P&L of the fund itself. So investors aren't playing, you know, investors aren't paying for themselves. The fund management company's got to pay for this research, which has meant basically there is less research around, particularly down at the small and mid cap end. And I think that's bad news because If there's less research around, there's less debate. If there's less debate, there's less perfect pricing. If there's less perfect pricing, then you're going to get volatility when news comes out. And if there's more volatility, it means, in my view, there is more difficulty in setting the price that can be used to raise more funds for a company. So I don't think it's great for capital markets and capital raising that we've got MiFID II. So less independent research has those byproducts, poor byproducts or bad results for the market. But also it now means that I think investors are going to have to use their annual report much more and dig into it much more for information, because frankly, there's going to be less information around about small and mid-caps, certainly, than there was in the past. And one good place to get that information is the annual report. And so that's why I think it's now becoming an important document, or more important document than perhaps it was in the past.
Would you say that because of the increased volatility and I guess implied less efficient markets, there's more opportunities for astute investors to sort of take advantage of that? Or
yeah, I guess so. But if there's more volatility, you can have more upside and more downside. So
right.
I just preferred it the way it was before, when there was, you know, a fair amount of debate about companies, a fair amount of discussion, and a lot of opinion formers out there in the market, which is good, because the more opinion formers and the more debate, the more volume and the more price, the better pricing you're going to get, and more accurate pricing and less volatility. And that you don't want too much volatility. If you run a mid cap and your share price is going up 10-15%, you know, on a day's trading, it isn't that helpful in determining strategy for the company itself.
Right. You've also said the best gamekeepers are often former poachers. In an ideal world, without being impractical, what legislation would you encourage to bring out more independent research and improve the standards of financial reporting, especially after MiFID II?
Well, I just I'd like it to go back to where it was before, where we had lots of people writing research and or more people writing research. I mean, frankly, some of the research wasn't great, but at least there was research, and at least there was comment.
Right.
And comment has to be good. If people aren't saying anything about a company, then it's very difficult to get a view.
Right.
And also, talking to companies is becoming much more complicated these days. You know, you can only talk to a company a certain time of the year, and they tend to speak to everyone at the same time. There's a lack of information, and having more independent research going on adds that information. I really think the more information about a company that's knocking around, the better. I think we're getting less now.
Yeah. At one point, you had over £3 billion of exposure, mostly in short positions. Would you be interested in writing a book on spotting valuable long positions at all at some point?
Not really. Not so fun. Not really.
That's fair enough.
No, it's not. I mean, to be honest, all companies, generally, they go up and they go down. Okay? They all have this sort of shape that goes up and it goes down. And nothing is forever.
Right.
So, but when companies go down, they often really don't come back.
Right.
So any company that, you know, I would wax lyrical about, you know, in 5 years' time, you can bet your bottom dollar that it'd be lower than when I wrote about it.
Wow.
It's just the way companies are. They have a finite life.
Yeah.
They come and they go. I mean, there are very few companies that just keep going on and on forever, certainly in the UK anyway. you know, I think that's probably the case all around the world. So no, much more interesting to do the ones that, you know, aren't so successful. And
usually they go down quicker, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, they fall off, they dive like the High Cliff Divers of Acapulco.
Right. As you said in your book, amazing.
Yes, they dive. The difference between the High Cliff Divers of Acapulco and stock market disasters is that is that there's never been a casualty in the high cliff, the high cliff divers of Acapulco. No one's ever died falling off, jumping off the cliffs there, but there certainly are casualties in companies that fall in the same way.
Right. I wonder if there's a correlation between when you read the book and Google searches for the Carolina divers.
We'll see. We'll see.
I had to Google it. So.
Yeah, right. Well, I think we talk about wingsuits now and proximity divers, don't we?
Yeah. That's true. last question. If readers were to take away one thing from your book, what would you want it to be?
Cash is facts. Everything else is a matter of opinion.
I would agree.
Everything else is a matter of opinion, matter of judgment. But the only thing you can believe is cash. Well, most of the time, anyway.
Right. Well, Tim, I want to thank you very much for your time and for coming on the podcast today.
It's a pleasure.